I had a recent experience. You know, this time of year, I think I said this a few months ago. This time of year is always fraught for me in the corporate world. It's just there's a lot of hopes and dreams, a lot of like things going on, and you know, I can't help myself but get involved, which is ironic. I was you know, we're going to talk about this recent series that I did about like how to survive and thrive at work, and you know, I watch it and I'm like, ah, that's good advice I should take, but you know, I get a little too involved. But today, I think maybe I reached the apex. Well, not today. This is sometime this week. Sometime recently, I think I reached the apex where now it's the downward slope of calm after this beginning of the year. And there was, you know, there's a big meeting, lots of people,
yeah,
about some, you know, big strategy thing or something. And, I was a little interested in what was going on, and I felt like, you know, it could have been said a little better, and I permitted myself to write a question in the chat window or the Zoom thing or whatever.
Uh-huh.
And you know, of course, immediately I was like, why did I do that? Especially when I got a reply to it, and I was just like, but you know, this is a particular trap that I usually catch myself with, but I think it's worth going over if you're a, you know, not to be all like I'm a fancy lad here or whatever, but like, you know, especially if you're in the kind of second half of your career, if you've been successful and you're sort of like, you're in this more senior position, right? And, you know, in the tech world, there is a lot written about what it means to be a senior tech team lead developer. There's whole Substack and blog empires and publishing book personas written about like, what does it mean to be a senior technical person? And it's just like, there's a lot of stuff there, right? And so if you're not careful, you'll have read all this stuff over the 15, 20 years of your career. Or I don't know, maybe if you're like some hotshot out there in the valley, the 5 or 10 years of your career, and you'll be like, now that I'm a senior person. Oh, and then the worst is if you have ever had to write your own new, not a job description, but in order to get promoted, HR has to invent a whole new thing.
Oh my gosh. A new band. So, a new salary position.
Yeah. And that's not as like fancy pants as it sounds. It just means that in the part of the company that you're in some cell in a spreadsheet somewhere, in some, mm-hmm, you know, forgotten node of Workday, someone needs to add a field. Right.
The job architecture must be updated.
Right. And so you've got to go in there and you've got this absurd spreadsheet of like 7 to 8 positions of a job. And the description in it is just, it's just like soul crushing. It's soul crushing in the way that you're like, is this, after however many thousands of years, is this what we have figured out? Is this where we have arrived at, that we're writing this kind of thing? So anyways, especially if you've had to like write, help author your own band to get into your job, and you're like, oh man, I'm in the senior position. Part of my job is to like, you know, ask the tough questions and stuff. And I permitted myself to sink into this, and I've thought about nothing about it since. I'm just like, what the fuck was I doing? Like, that's like, there is no anyone who
is asking a question in like the town hall.
Just sort of like one of those, like, it's the question you're thinking and you know everyone else is thinking, but no one will ask it. Right. Mm-hmm. And you're like, this is the job. I remember the 6 requirement under things that you do in that job position that I helped co-write 2 years ago.
Right.
Because it didn't exist. It was something about like, you know, whatever, speaking out or freely or something, right? And especially if you've read all of the job advice to go back to it in the tech world, this is just like, if you're all like, I could recite Paul Graham backward to you. It's just like, this is like number one thing, right? Like crazy, whatever guy.
Don't ask the question in the town hall.
And here, this is what I couldn't put in the O'Reilly videos, that almost at the end of several pieces of advice, I would say, fuck that. Don't do that. That's fucking stupid.
Well, hold on. Before we're going to jump in here in a second, we're going to get to your O'Reilly videos to give people a little preview of that. But I think it's worth, like, I think the town hall, I've been thinking a lot about town halls lately. So let me throw out to you some changes I've been contemplating that will not happen. But I think if I was to redesign the world, this is what I would be. So first of all, my comments are applying to mostly just virtual town halls. So it's like, okay, there's a big town hall meeting. You're in a large company, people are around the world, you know, and so there's no perfect time zone. And it typically comes out that you're going to have a series of executives get on something like a Teams call, a WebEx, or, you know, they'll use some other type of presentation software only used for large meetings. Right.
Oh, okay. Okay. Yeah. If I could help craft this, they're going to use the webinar mode in Zoom.
Yes, right. Those things, right? And then, of course, they're going to allow – they'll use some type of social engagement, like ask a question. You can vote on the question stuff, right? So my thought first is that, like, one, at this point – and I'm thinking Gen Z will do this. It's like, really, there's no reason for these to be live, right? That the people – like, all the executives should just record videos. Like, and I think Gen Z will do this because it's a very, like, TikTok – kind of, you know, reels of thing. It's like, no, like, it is important. I actually am interested in, like, what the executives have to say, but I think it'd be much better for them to just make the video of what they want to say and just send it out to everyone, because there's not a lot of reason for that. And also too, they can make sure they can do it at a time that works for all of them. And, you know, they can get the properly edited. They can have a transcript, whatever. And then, of course, they could collect questions beforehand. And most of the time, I think, as you already alluding to, the popular topics are already well known. Like, you can get on most town hall meetings, and you're going to be like, someone's going to ask about A, B, and C. And, A, B, and C would be a little different for every company, but it's kind of the same. So they could just hit on those, and then they could maybe filter the questions they think would have the widest audience, right? And then you could just ask them. Because my theory about the town hall is that the questions when people are asked is that, if you want to ask a question, the question you really want to answer is the follow-up question, right? So if you ask a question in the group chat, the person will answer it, but there will be no follow-up, right? Because they'll just say, well, I'm so-and-so, right? And therefore, then what they're going to do is give you probably the simplest talking point answer, which is maybe appropriate for the whole thing. But in that case, you already kind of know that. So just give us the video. And if you really wanted to have a Q&A, you want to have an interviewer, because, like, if you've ever interviewed anyone or been interviewed yourself, the follow-up questions are where new information is sort of elicited.
Totally.
Right? You get something new, right? So otherwise, you're just going to get the talking point answer. And I think what it does is it gives the presenter this false sense of accomplishment. Like, I took questions and I answered them all. It's like, not really. I mean, you did do that, of course, but what we all want is the follow-up question, because you're like, we know there. And I think if you think of a town hall and side of a company, it's more like therapy than it is about, like, information, right? Like, inside a company, like you already alluded to, we know what the, if you will, the difficult discussion points are, just like you would go to a therapist and then be like, well, you know, Michael, we've been working on XYZ with you. Like, it's not like a new subject, right? And it's like, where can we go to the next level versus, like, hey, you're like, what time is lunch, right? That's like just an informational question, right? It's not going to change. There doesn't need to be a lot of follow-up. And so that's what I think, you know, a lot of times people, often executives, but I think it's also just people that give lots of these town halls, they're kind of missing that, right? They're missing the point. It's like, no. It's like, you didn't really answer the question that we really care about. You just kind of feel like you did, because no one's scared to say to you, well, let me have a follow-up. And of course, if you see this, if you watch the press, whether it's politics, sports, or even popular culture, it's the follow-up questions that we're there for. Go ahead.
Yeah, you know, maybe this would be another good video series to do. But I feel like, you know, this is evoking a lot of thoughts I've had over the years, is that in the company town hall, ask me anything, whatever it is, meeting, I think the only thing I'm always in all corporate jobs, I'm always very aware of when you make your work product, there's this phrase I use for it. You don't want your work product to be a book report, which is like this report about how you figured out what the problem was. You figured out how to describe the problem. and now you're giving a, you know, an elementary school, you don't write, you know, a middle school book report. And the first thing they tell you about writing book reports that no one ever follows, except if you're writing for like the New York Times Book Review or London Book People, whatever, a book report should not tell you what happened in the book. It needs to tell you like what someone thought about the book and what it means for culture, blah, blah, blah. But everyone who writes a book report who's not a professional just tells you what happens in the book.
Right.
Now, we have a word for that in the business world, and that is outcomes. Mm-hmm. Right. And in a town hall, no one gives a fuck about the outcome. Like, they don't want to know what the business desires that out its outcome to be, what the numbers need. I mean, it's good to know what the numbers are, but that's just like 30 seconds in a slide that you're going to get afterwards. Like, what they want to know is, what the fuck should I be doing? Right? And like, that very rarely, at least in my experience over many, many companies, very rarely comes out, right? Very rarely are you told like, all right, these people should do this. These people should be doing that. And then someone was discussing OKRs a couple weeks ago, I think it was John Willis. He wrote up, I think he might have some AI helping him write his blog post, which is cool. But it is a good example of like, if you go read his blog post, you can, I know it's not just that, but he's got an interesting writing style going on in his blog post. But I don't mean to be rude. I'm just pointing out something I think is fascinating. But he was writing about like what Deming would think of OKRs. And it was making me realize that like, that's what I don't like about OKRs is they don't tell me what the fuck to do. It's just like, sure, I would love to make more money. And
that's right. Yes.
Right. And so like the idea of an objective is like cool. And a key result is also cool. But there's something between the O and the KR that I've always struggled with in corporate life, which is you can't give me a number if you haven't sat down and imagined how I'm going to get to that number.
Yeah.
Otherwise, you're just like fucking around. Right. Like there's no connection between reality and what you want. And, you know, sure, if you're working in the kind of like, I'm trying to hustle up investors to think there's a good story here, then even that, what's between the O and the KR is something called marketing. Right. And then so like, you should be specifying how you're going to craft this story. And, you know, it doesn't have to be make things up, but how you're going to explain something that an investor didn't previously understand that gets you this value for them. I'm kind of trailing off here, but like this is something that I think in an internal meeting, right? The shift should be towards what are we all and individually going to do? And what tools am I as an executive giving you to do that, right? Because like the outcome is kind of irrelevant. Like, you know, you need to know how you're going to get there and what you have available to you.
And I do think what you're saying there is, and this is kind of back to the idea around the video. It's more like, I think the video is a forcing function for anyone making it to be like, okay, like why should someone watch this video? And there can be lots of reasons. One thing could just be like, I'm executive group and I just want people to understand our mission or the thing. And I've got to say it.
Sure. It's like educational.
Yeah. And I want them to remind that. I want to give them some new examples. Or I need to tell them a specific thing, or I want them to kind of, you know, see who I am and then what I'm thinking about the company and all those things. But I think that's the video part of it, sort of like forces, if you will, the person to come up and be like, this is what I'm here to say, versus like they're so easy to fall into the trapping of like slides and then questions. And it's like, really, yeah, the questions, that's not really that necessary. And then, of course, you know, maybe a controversial take here is just sort of like, I think for the most part, a lot of the town hall questions, like you don't really. I think people do it with the right intentions, but like, I don't think you need them most of the time. Right. I think it's actually kind of a distraction because therapy, it's like, if we're not here to talk about the big issues, like, and we're not going to really work through them today. Right. Then let's just kind of skip that. We don't have to pretend we're going to do it. We're not going to address like, you know, organizational, like, decisions that are holding back the company and that are very frustrating that are well known. Like, we're not going to do that at every town hall, right? Maybe there's a time and a place for that, but it's not a town hall meeting. So
I mean it's almost like to be I don't know, kind of jerkish about it. There's some instances where people are asking questions during these town halls are like the reply guy in Twitter. in the sense of like, is there any question that's going to be asked that will change anything that is happening? Right. And now it's fine to ask like a clarifying question. And I like your idea that like every, it's the second question that people want to get to, which, you know, that's good. I don't know. But yeah, town hall, it's really hard to do a town hall meeting in a big company. And on the other hand, it probably is kind of easy if you put yourself in the position of being an audience member and just always being like, so what am I going to do? I don't know. It's hard to walk that line. I don't envy a lot of executive people. It's hard to walk that line between therapy and action or something like that.
No, absolutely. And I think that sort of brings us maybe to our main topic today. So Cote, you've been out making some nice videos here. You've been, I guess with O'Reilly, you've made 10 videos on the theme is called How to Survive and Thrive in a Large Corporate Organization, rather. And so what I thought we'd do today is we'd pick out a couple of them. And if people like it, they can, of course, in the show notes, there'll be a link. They can go sign up at O'Reilly, or maybe they'll log in through their corporate account and they can watch them all. But I thought maybe we'd start with, you know, kind of almost the subject we were talking about before. One of the modules is titled "To Understand How a Big Company Works." So why don't we start there? It's maybe deceptively simple, but complicated at the same time. So give us your wisdom here. How does a big company work?
Well, so this unit, or they call them modules. I phrased it this way because I wanted to like try to put in place an idea of how you should be an employee in a large organization. And the logical thing to me was that you should think the same way a large organization thinks and the way they exist. And the way that is now, obviously, if you're working for a nonprofit organization, things are different. So we'll put that over there. That's a whole other category. But if you're working for a profit-driven company, you know, we talk about this on the podcast every now and then. Like the point of a profit-driven company is to the top three things is you want to make money, make profit, and in certain situations, make your share price go up. Sometimes you just want it to not go down, right? Right. And there's variations on those things, right? And especially in the tech world, and we comment on this a lot. Especially in the tech world, a lot of how a company operates, even big companies, is based on the third, really maintaining that share price. And having a lot of revenue and profits certainly helps. It doesn't hurt. But as we've seen, it's not necessary to have like a high share price. So in thinking about how someone should operate in a company, like I wanted to try to introduce this model that was exactly that, right? Except kind of from the reverse, that like, well, let's say that the large company you work for is your customer, right? And you are the large company. So if you use that same logic when thinking about a large company, how does that change how you think about how you do your work? And I think like, I think it has a lot of things that it changes that oddly enough, like as I was making these, I was realizing, you know, as cynical as they may seem, that a lot of it kind of aligns with the whole, like, you know, take care of yourself first sort of movement we've seen in the last 10, 15 years. But my conclusion from thinking that way is that like, well, a company, any commercial enterprise, their dream is to do zero work and get maximum revenue, right? Because any amount of work or costs, your COGS that you do, is subtracted from your revenue, and that's money that you lose. You can think about it other ways, but that's the way it is. So as an individual, you should always be thinking about, and this is like, I always feel cautious about talking like this, because as we were joking before we were recording, like this kind of advice I'm about to say would be great if I would follow it. My life would be a lot easier. But like, you know, what that means is, what is the minimal amount of work you can do to make the maximal amount of money? Because that's exactly how your large organization is thinking, right? They're never like, you know what? We could have paid $500 for that, but why don't we pay $800 instead, right? Like, right. So they're always looking to like minimize the cost going into things. And that is, I mean, it's not everything that capitalism is, but it's almost the only principle, no pun intended, of capitalism is, you know, it's not even spend less. It's, I mean, basically, yeah, it's like spend less than you take in. Capitalism, right?
But I think what you're kind of getting at there, a couple of things I think jump out at me is sort of like as a, just say, I think you use the word worker, middle manager, I think maybe non-executive, right, is maybe the way we're thinking about it, is that a lot of times I do think people don't do this is to start with the simplest thing. And there are, like, I think you even mentioned this in the video, you say something like, you know, you can go read the earnings report. And there's actually a lot of tools now that will actually visualize the earnings for you. And you know, and sometimes it's like when you see the revenue visualized, you'll find that like, oh, it turns out like we, our company makes like 80% of the revenue from like this product. Right. And when you start to look, when you start kind of that way and you're just sort of like, well, really everybody in the company, certainly in the executives, are going to be focused in on that. So it's sort of like, you know, start there, right? At least understand that motivation first, right? And then as what I think you're getting to, it's like, okay, what are the tasks and things that I'm going to do? And this is a little work you have to do on your own. And how does it map to that like large revenue thing? And I think this is where, and then to where I think you're getting to, it's like, well, what are the most highest impact things I can do there, right? With the minimum amount of time and effort to make that impact. And it's sort of
right,
like,
right,
you kind of walk that chain. It's like, okay, that right there, that is your core job. That's your core job function. And that's what you should do. So like, to just give some examples here, maybe we'd say it's like, you know, sometimes people get caught up on like we do, like, you know, DevOps or Agile or using open source. And it's like, okay, like those are all good things. Those, you know, but like you need to then map it. It's like, okay, we are either going to open source this because I understand how that will impact the revenue, or we're going to use open source, to your point, Cote, because that's going to reduce costs, or we're going to use one of these Agile or, you know, DevOps methodology because we can do those things. And if you are struggling, right, to show the value or to be able to draw that line, you may know that may be a place where it's like, hey, this is a really uphill battle. Right. Like it's a real hard to draw the line there. So that's where I think, you know, to your point, you've got to think about as a person and thinking about their own business is like, well, if those things aren't going to move that needle, right, in a way that's helpful, what are some other things I can do? Or do I need to find a place? If this is my passion, what I want to work on, this gives me the most job satisfaction, then do I need to find a place where I think I can, if you will, implement these levers in a way that could help another company move forward? And I think that's where the struggle with so many of these, these things are.
Yeah. I haven't really thought about what you're saying in this way, but what you're making me think, which is great, is that, you know, there's, I forget what scientists, but this is the advice again, if you're like in these high powered, whatever apex of your career things, one of the pieces of advice you always get is to work on the most important things in your industry, right? Like, or whatever is the most impactful. Like you're saying, if 80% of your company's revenue comes from some product, you should probably be working on that, right? Like not these minor things. And the way I've always thought about that is that it means, I'll just summarize it with one word, the more glory that you'll get, you know, money and stuff like that. But what you're making me think, tied with my way of looking at it, is like, well, but if the impact is bigger per unit of work, that means you have to do less work for something that has a smaller impact. I mean, this is like, it's also making me realize that, like, I've now known salespeople for like 10 years or so, having worked at Pivotal and VMware and everything. And like, this is how salespeople think. Salespeople don't think, what can I do to work 40 or 50 hours a week to go make money? Now, what they think is, how can I make my number in the shortest amount of time?
Absolutely. Right?
So they want to find like the biggest amount of money that's the easiest to get. And once they get that, they're out. Right. And so like, and so what they're doing is they're focusing on the biggest impact, the biggest result, the most important thing, right? Like everyone would say, if you can go land HSBC, Bank of America, or the Department of Defense, you win. Yep. Right. Like that's the most important thing for a salesperson to do in tech. And so like, that doesn't mean that you're going to be working like 60 hours a week all year, it means you're going to have that one impact and then you're like off to club and you're done.
Yeah. And I think this kind of brings us to like maybe thinking about the biggest thing that I think people, individual, you know, listening, and we'll use the worker middle management role, the things that you can control is oftentimes it's not obvious that like you can go make triple your salary by doing this at the company, right? That's usually not how the compensation is set up in most places. But the things I think you can think about that you call it in your video here is how much time are you going to work? What's the kind of the pleasure you get of doing the work, kind of the self-motivation, and then kind of like, who are you with? The culture and the people. So I think that's the thing, you know, people can always be taking stock of. It's sort of, and it's like I was saying before, it's like, well, I may be passionate about these things. I'm, you know, some examples already mentioned, but it may take a lot of time and it may not move, you know, that the upper needle. Right. So then I got to decide, well, what, how much time do I want to put into it? What are the things I could put into it in a reasonable work week and actually make some impact? And I think to your point, that's really your, if you will, that's your currency is like how much time. It's your, you know, one of people here, I think, Brian or systems guy was in here saying it's like it's all about leverage, right? It's like if I can spend my time doing this and get a lot more leverage out of it, right? Just me have a bigger impact. That's what people want you to do, right? That's and that hopefully should give you more time to do either work more because that's what you want to do or do other things in your life.
Yeah, exactly.
So, all right, that's how we understand a big company work. Now, let's this other one I thought was really interesting, Cote. It's I guess it's the other modules, module one. So we went out of order, but it's the idea here is to learn why you cultivate your style and character. So I think this idea, I think this metaphor you kind of have going through your talks here is sort of like almost like literary, right? Fiction, right? So it's like if the company, if you will, is the big, if you will, world you're working in, you know, you ultimately, you kind of talk about wanting to create a character inside that world. So why don't you tell us, like, what do you mean by that? What does it mean to develop a character at your corporation?
So I think, to your point, the first thing to add to what you're saying is, you know, a character exists in a story. And we kind of went over the story to a certain extent, right? Like, and you even mentioned, like, if you don't know your company's story, I mean, this is all for large companies. Go read the annual report and you'll get the story. They're like legally required to tell you the story. So it will be in there. And it's I don't really do this very often, but it's usually very well written. Like it's very clear and concise. Yeah, you can get the story. Example,
I think, you know, too, I think it's fair to say Alphabet, the story is like Google search, right? They make tons of money. Like,
yeah,
that would be really like when I say Apple, they make great iPhones. Like, you know what I'm saying? You can just like, it's not like when we say this, it's not like you have to do like an incredible amount of analysis for most companies, but go on.
And so I think the important thing of knowing your character and style is there's at least two things. And I have to admit this video, like when I don't know about you when you do videos, but I've done this long enough that I can kind of like watch myself in an out of body experience when I'm doing these things. And so while I was doing it and while I was editing it and afterwards, I was like, I kind of don't know what the fuck I'm talking about here. So we'll see if I can figure it out. But what I was shooting for was like a lot of it comes down to the group dynamics of predictability and dependability, right? And so if you're working in a large organization, you're just like, even if you're an executive, you're often just like this cog in a wheel, right? Like everyone has a boss. And so your life is going to be easier if you're not unpredictable in a company. Like the point of a large company is, as I think we've joked about, is winning. Like it's not to like strive and be chaotic and do crazy stuff. You know, just have your whole board turned over the weekend, like OpenAI or whatever. But it's just stability, just like bringing in cash, right? Like you got to think of a company like, you know, do you like chaos and craziness in your monthly paycheck? No, you just like it to be constant. And so in that way, it's important for the people you interact with the company to like be able to size you up and know what your deal is, like how you fit in there, like what you can help them with, what you can't help them with. You don't want to be like an unpredictable sort of thing. So it's hard to kind of figure out what your character is at first. And so you've got to figure out like, what official role do I have in the way that I want to interact with people, the way that I want to do a job, like how does that build upon my character? What am I kind of, I don't know, for lack of a better phrase, allowed to do in the role that I have? And you kind of establish this persona that you have at work, right? And we have, like, not to be all like, I don't know if it's Freudian or Jungian or whatever, but, you know, to be all early 20th century psychology stuff, like, you have multiple personas in all parts of your life, right? And the more that you can establish and stick to a persona that you have at work, I think the easier work will be for you. Now, there's a couple of things to say about that. One, you know, the first part that I've already said is, like, it's good to be predictable, to be reliable, right? Like, people in big companies, I keep saying it, they love predictability. Like, and the main thing they like is, if I ask you to do something, it will get done. Right. Nope. And like, if I delegate a task to you that involves you going and working with other people, I know how that's going to go. Right. Like, it's going to be expected, and on and on and on. Right. I mean, just like in your own life, like, if you ask a plumber to come fix your toilet and you come home and they built you like a balcony on your second floor, you probably don't like that.
Not good.
Yeah. Right.
No, it's all right.
And so establishing that character is good. Now, the second thing is that this doesn't mean that you stay in that character, but it helps guide if you want to do something different with your job. It helps you figure out how to evolve that character and become a different character. And everyone does this in like performance plans. Speaking of OKRs, it's like, here you are now. Where do you want to get to in a year? Right. And like, so this kind of helps you out with that, because you know what your character is, and you can think about in a literary way, as you say, how you would evolve to that other character. And then finally, I think the other thing that's handy with this character thing is, like, especially in a large organization, maybe not so much in your personal life, but when you're in an organization that is like, I don't know, that's like a large organization, it's often of great utility to just be able to be in character, right? And just be like, oh, I'm this character. I can just do that, right? Like, whether or not it's good or bad, like, I play that role. And to make an analogy that I'm probably going to mess up, because, like, I don't know anything about the military, I feel like when you become a soldier or a sailor or all the other various words people have for it, like, part of what that is establishing this character that you can just fall back on. And not have to, like, in every single situation, you don't have to evaluate what to do and what would someone do in this situation. You just play the character, right? Yeah. And that's very handy in a corporate world.
Yeah. And I, you know, I really took to this too, a couple other things out of it. I think it's, you know, as a character for yourself, I think, and I think maybe sometimes even the word, we're probably making it seem like, oh, you're fake. It's a character, but I don't mean it this way. I think it's sort of like just developing some level of expertise. So to follow up what you were saying before, it's like, one, it's great that your boss or someone knows that, like, I can ask so-and-so, you know, to do this. I know it's going to be done. But it's also even better if you're kind of known for doing something. I know exactly. I ask so-and-so.
Your reputation.
And I think, you know, like, I'll just use an example. Like, many companies have somebody who's like, this is the person that gives the great live demo, right? Like, that's what they're known for. I know if I ask so-and-so to give the great live demo, they're going to do an awesome job. And therefore, once you get known for that, that's what you're asked to do. Then hopefully...
Yeah, you
develop that skill. Hopefully that's something you like doing. And then over time, right, that sort of becomes, if you will, your basis of expertise. And then that allows you to kind of do other things. Now, I think most companies won't say this, but, like, I actually think, well, it's great, like, to do that at one company. But then your best chance to, if you will, switch characters, kind of like changing teams or like going to another play, is like going to another company, right? And there you can kind of reinvent yourself. But for example... I've done something like this. Coach, you've done similar things. It's like, maybe at one place you're just like the developer, but at the next place, like, you're the sales engineer, right? You know what I mean? So those have different connotations, right? Like, oh, I don't deal with customers. I do deal with customers, but sometimes it's better to, like, just go somewhere else and be like, yeah, when I go to this new job, I'm going to be the sales engineer. I'm going to be customer facing. Whereas my last job, I was, like, in support or something like that. Or, you know, in politics, you kind of see this where it's like, often you'll see somebody who's really smart, who's like the messaging speechwriter, but they're behind the scenes for a while. And then eventually their next job, they become like the pundit or the spokesman, right? But like people that didn't, as they go to like a different candidate, right? They're running for a different campaign, different role. So I think it's important to be like, maybe it's sort of like, what's your character now? And when you get tired of that character, you've kind of grown beyond it. I'm not saying it always has to, but it feels like a natural point is to like switch jobs and then use that opportunity. And I think, you know, you know, to talk about kids, you know, just because we both have kids in this age, is like, you see middle schoolers do this a lot. Like middle schoolers kind of like, you know, they, as they switch grades or they switch schools into high school and certainly from high school to college, they kind of, if you take that opportunity to kind of redefine themselves, and there's nothing wrong. I think that's a good thing. Right. And I think that's probably very much the kind of thing we do as adults. And I think I know Cote, you know, at one point you were a developer and then you're an analyst and then, you know, now you're on to even other great things.
All so this wacky shit.
We've all done something similar like this in our careers.
Yeah. And just as a small thing to point out, like, I forget if I mentioned this in the video, but as you're saying, which I think is worth amping up, another benefit of establishing a character and a style is internal visibility, right?
Yeah.
And I don't really talk a lot in this series about promotions and career advancement. It's more like inward looking, as it says, how to survive and thrive, right? Like how to stay sane is another way of putting it. But developing that character and that style is a huge part of your reputation inside the company, which when you get to, like, let's say above the second level of promotion, whether you're an individual contributor or a manager, like the third time you're going to be promoted, what matters is that other people in the company know you outside of your group.
Right.
And that's where this character and style thing becomes very valuable and why it's important to really cultivate just like that panache and all of that stuff that seems really repugnant until you get paid more because you have it.
That's right. All right. Well, this next topic, I love this one. This was probably the one that really jumped out to me the most when I was kind of reviewing some of your videos. So it's mentors are nice, champions are better. And I was like, wow, this kind of hit home to me. So I don't know, maybe it's worth defining what's a mentor, what's a champion, and why is it better to be a champion, Cote?
So when I was making this one, this is like in the introduction, I they didn't ask me to make an introduction, but I was like, I got to introduce this stuff because it's a little weird. But when the introduction video, I tried to point out that like, this all seems very cynical, but I don't mean it to be, right? Like, it's just like, this is just like I was saying, this is just like some therapy, how to stay sane. And in this one, I had to work really hard to not say mentors are bullshit, because I don't actually believe that. But like the magnitude that champions are better than mentors is so great that it's really easy to dismiss a mentor, right? And a mentor is exactly what you would think it is. I'll build up some suspense before I get to champions. You know, and a mentor is good. Like, and I have a weird relationship with mentors, right? Because I do not like being in a subservient position to someone on any axes, whether it's knowledge or whatever. And like, I don't know. I'm thinking of people who have been mentors to me and like regretting or being proud of like how much I leveled the playing field with them, right? That we're just having like an exchange of equals. But a mentor is nice because like you do need help, right? And especially if you're in this kind of shifting between roles and moving around, like you need someone that is trusted and friendly who can just kind of like help you out. And coach is almost a good word for it. But again, because I'm not in sports, like I don't like that analogy, because a coach also has external, usually commercial driven goals apart from just making you a good person. Whereas like a mentor, the best mentors are just interested. They're not like parents, but they're interested in seeing your career develop. And they'll be like, I've been there before, or I know about that. And they'll just give you advice about what to do.
I think you're saying a word there before you set up anything. I think they're interested, but I'm going to put this words in your mouth here. They're interested, but they're not invested. Right. And that's why why, you know, everyone can give advice. Mentors are fine. People that give advice, but they're not necessarily invested in you in a way a champion can be. So go on.
Yeah. Yeah. And you got to have mentors. Right. And I think to close it out, I think the key thing with mentors is to identify if you have mentors already. And if you don't, then you can go into all the literature and the official programs. And if you work in a large company, there's probably some mentor program. And, you know, but if you don't have mentors, you should figure out getting some, right? But you've got to tune yourself to figure out, like, are the people I go to who mentor me and help me? Now, a champion, and I'll give full credit to the person who made me realize this. So at Dell, the second boss that I had was this guy Namdi, and he was fantastic. He was the best boss I've had he was probably the top two bosses that I've had. And I learned a lot from him. And he was, before he was my manager, he was a champion for me. And he explained this concept to me. And the concept is that in a large organization, the way that you're going to keep your sanity, which is the point of this whole series, be able to get your job done without it being stressful, and also advance your career, is that you're going to need someone who is at least three, if not more, levels above you, who knows about you and is going to stick up for you, basically be your champion, right? In the Gresham sense of it, right? Or whatever. And what this champion does is that when you are not around and some shit is going down, they're going to be like, nope, we should not fire Cote. right? Or that's the negative version of it. But like, you know what? Let's put him on this other spreadsheet, right? Like, yep. And then the positive version is that when you're looking to get something done and you don't really have the, I'm trying to use like a non whatever phrase, but you don't really have like the political capital or the power, or the connections to like get something that you need to or you want done, the champion often has that power and they will come in and help you out with it or just do it for you, right? And this is what I learned from Namdi and other people, is like, you've got to cultivate these relationships with people that don't even need to be in your direct line of management, but there's almost, there will be a couple of groups at the top of your organization that really like, I mean, it's how an org chart works. Like an org chart has many people at the bottom and then just a few people at the top, right? And you want your champions to kind of be in those upper echelons, because that's where like the major decisions are made. And so the champion, you know, it's hard to have, you can have a couple of them, but they're these people who are in those very senior positions who know about you and are willing to like stick up for you. And, you know, like me, you can be very lucky and just kind of fall into having one. Although maybe to give myself a little bit more credit, you know, what's a champion's interest in you, right? Like they could be friendly with you, which is totally fine. But as with any large organization, back to understanding how large organizations work, it is a very transactional sort of relationship, right? But it's that very human transactional thing of like, you don't have to pay me now, but maybe someday you can help me out, right? And right. So like oftentimes, like what you'll experience with a champion, the way that you, if you're lower down than them, and I always hate the judgmentalness of like this spatial orientation of stuff, but whatever. But if you're lower down in the chart than them, oftentimes what a champion will ask you to do is to help them with some work product that they are incapable of doing, either because they are not a subject matter expert at it, or because they don't have time to do it, or because they don't, ironically, it's not ironic, but like interestingly, they don't have access low enough down in the organization to make it happen, right? Or to like even know what's going on. So what you do for a champion is maybe they need a memo written about whatever, right? Like their boss or their boss's boss was like, what's the deal with AirPods? Right.
It's so successful.
And I had the situation happen with lots of people who are my champions, is, you know, this is another thing about champions, is they have that aspect of mentors where you're at the very least work friends with them, right? So you talk with them a lot and you run into them and they might casually just be like, and I'm just making up this example, they're just like, oh yeah, what do you think about AirPods? And like, is that a good business? Like, should we be in the AirPods business? And like, they're asking you this because they know that you have some subject matter expertise and you'll talk about it and you talk with them for maybe like 15 minutes. And they're like, hey, do you think you could write that up in like a 2-page memo? And you're like, yeah, sure. And they're like, and could you send that to me in 2 hours? And so like every now and then the champion's going to come in and like ask you for this little task, because their boss or their boss's boss or like the board of directors or some shit has asked them like, we think we should get into AirPods. Send me a memo, or like, we're going to have a meeting later today about it. And I want you to present our case of AirPods pro or against. Right. Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, that's just one kind of example, but the champion's going to come in and ask you for those little favors, I guess is a word that you want, but they're definitely like something that you need to cultivate.
Yeah. And I think, you know, maybe it's worth taking a moment to kind of chain some of these topics together we've been talking about. So like, you know, think about a champion, right? A champion is just another employee at a company. And what are they looking for? They're looking for leverage from somebody. So kind of like if we think about, you know, kind of the perfect employee, kind of thinking about all this through, it's like, you know, you join the company, you understand how the big company works because, you know, you went out and you read the annual report and you understand where the money's coming from and you understand the things that you can do to change that. And if you've done that, then you probably built up a character, right? And a character allows you to kind of develop some level of expertise, develop a reputation about doing something really, really well. And that, I think, is how champions, you know, are aware of all the characters in their company, right? And they're kind of looking around for people that are going to provide them more leverage, right? That's back to, you know, the example is like, you know, oftentimes an executive will see someone give a demo, right? And they'll be like, the next time they'll be like, can you please have so-and-so come give this demo, right? Or, or they could have so-and-so come, you know, talk about this specific subject. And that's really how you find the champion, right? Is you've done those things. That's the way to get noticed. And then you at the same time are simultaneously probably looking at all the different executives and trying to figure out like, who do you like? Who can you provide some leverage to? What are you good at? What are they maybe not so good at? Right. Or back to complementing strengths. Like maybe you are the great two-page memo writer and the deep expert kind of person. And you, if you will, it's like you're almost playing that chief of staff role. You're sitting behind the person in the meeting,
right?
And they have all the relationships to get you into the meeting. And you know, you can, and then that's your kind of, if you will, your entry into that room. And then finally, right, maybe you decide after a while that like, I've worked for this champion for great. I'm going to leave the company and I'm going to go be the executive. I'm going to, you know, if you will, go redefine my character and be an executive at the next job. Right. So,
so
it's all kind of related, right? You're kind of, we're always like, you know, if you will, we're all simultaneously, you know, if you will, playing all the roles and trying to learn from each other every moment.
Yeah. And you know, I don't think I mentioned this in the video, but like to add one more thing to that. I think one of the things that this is not universal, but in general, one of the things that your champion should do is you should be invited frequently, is too strong a word, but you should find yourself in the big meeting. Because the champion got you invited. Now, you're probably going to be sitting along the wall, not at the table, right? But if the champion, instead of like if the champion is the reason that you're at a big meeting, then you know they're your champion, right? Like otherwise you wouldn't be there. Like, and you know, it's a good sign that someone is, because it's one thing to like take advantage of someone to like get their knowledge and do stuff, but a good champion will be like, yeah, you should be there. Like you worked on this and like, maybe there'll be a question.
Right. That's the surest sign of the kind of like what I was saying before, like, you know, a champion is invested in you, right? Because
exactly.
When they invite you to the meeting, and sometimes people use this metaphor in meetings, like, you know, you have the table. If you're sitting at the table, you're sort of, if you will, in the infield. And if you're on the outside, you're on the outfield, right? You know, just use a sports metaphor, but it's like, hey, if someone brings you in and lets you sit in the outfield, right, they're invested in you, right? Because they brought you into the meeting and whatever you say reflects this versus like a mentor who just tells you, well, like you should go to the big meeting. You're like, well, you know, that's, you know,
and,
great.
And
it's your help, but that's not, you're not invested in me. You're interested in me, but you're not invested in me.
To give one of my characteristic weird references, there's a modern day, I forget who wrote it. I forget her name, but there's a modern day retelling of the Achilles story. And it's very clear. I mean, Achilles is the ultimate champion in a different way of putting it that I'll mess up here. But like, it's a great retelling of the Achilles story. And you can tell where the relationship between Agamemnon and Achilles is totally messed up because Agamemnon misunderstands how to treat. In this case, Agamemnon is like, Achilles is his sort of like, underling, if you will, and he totally messes up what you were just pointing out. And then Achilles is just like, fuck you, right? And it's a different version of the original Homer tale, which is much more modern. But go read that, and you'll understand how a champion is supposed to reward.
There you go. It all goes back to history, and is that Greek mythology? I don't know.
Yeah, ironically, Achilles is the champion in that point, but it's actually the roles are reversed for my metaphor here. But
all right, well, we're not going to let the facts get in the way of our history here. So listen, Coach, we've got to wrap up here, but I figured, like, you know, there are a total of 9 of these. We've hit on probably 4 of them, but listen, I want you to maybe end with the bang, right? We'll skip to the end, is to quickly give us your summation here is, and I think it's titled here, your real message is to focus on work-life imbalance. What do you mean by that?
Well, I think I stole this from like some TikTok video or something, but like when people talk about this phrase work-life imbalance, what they usually mean is that you're working too much. Whereas like, I think what you need to do is be living too much, right? And, you know, to have that kind of Australian attitude about things, right? That you, how does the phrase go? That you work to live instead of living to work. And you know, like I was joking about at the beginning, I think this idea is important to me because like a lot of the career advice I had in my head was based on all of this like high growth tech startup stuff, right? And you know, we've come to appreciate in recent years how that's all like a big hustle. Like it's all just a huge gamble that like if you sit eating ramen in an apartment, things are going to go well for you, right? Like it's not really cool. Now, if you know the parameters of things and you're like, my life is set up that I can sit and eat ramen in an apartment, then sure, whatever, right? Like you can kind of like try to, you can always try to be a good gambler, or you could just get a normal job, right? Right. Like it's numbers are weird. So like, you know, I think that like, you know, what kicked me off on writing a bunch of or thinking about this several years ago was like, really like that job that I had at Dell, which is like the first time I had I joke that like I got that job because our son Cormac was maybe like 1.5 or 2. And I worked at Red Monk at the time. And I don't mean this in whatever sort of negative way, but Kim was like, you got to get a real job, right? Like you travel too much, like you need something stable. And so I went from Red Monk to go work at Dell. And that was like the first real job that I had. And like, I went in there with all of that like tech career thinking, you know, all that optimism of Red Monk and like all the programmer stuff. And like, that is not how normal corporate life is. Like there were little parts of Dell here and there, but like Dell is just like a normal corporate company for the most part. Right. And any tech company is like that because it is so big that it becomes a normal company. And so I at first like started to apply like all this stuff to that corporate world. And then I realized like, oh, none of those rules apply here. Like the point of a corporate job is to maximize your take, and anything else you do, you're just like giving away free money. And even worse, you're just going to like damage yourself. Like I remember I would be in that job, and like, you know, obviously I quit working there after a couple of years, but every now and then I'd be working on some big project and I was very enthusiastic about it. I was learning how to do some Excel stuff and make some cool slides, but it would be like 1 a.m. in the morning and I would be sitting there on the couch, like sometimes even just like, I don't know, losing it and crying a little bit and being like, what am I doing here? Like I'm trapped in this crazy situation because like I had this misalignment between that engine of like startup growth and programmer growth and like this big behemoth of a large organization that was not set up for that mindset. And so like big companies will come in and like take advantage of this misalignment. And again, this is why it's important to understand how a big company operates. They want to make maximum money with minimum payment, right? And so like, you have to apply that same thing and be like, so what is my profit? My profit is my life, right? Like getting what I want, enjoying the life that I have. if I really enjoy working all the time, that's my life. And so I would like my job to do that. But if like I don't enjoy working all the time and there's other things that I want to do, I need to figure out, just like the company, how to maximize my life and minimize my work. And so the imbalance, more than likely for each employee, is every employee should be incented to imbalance towards their own life, right? Just like the company. Like a company would never say, like, I mean, I made this joke earlier. A company doesn't want a revenue profit imbalance, you know, going towards cost, basically. Like they don't want to imbalance the cost of something. So similarly, like it's absurd to run your life where your costs far exceed the revenue that you're bringing in. So yeah, I think it's good to focus on just like, how do I maximize my life, my take from this, versus maximize my output.
That's right. I like that. And I think it is good. In some ways, it's using the same corporate guidance that we've been talking about. It's just a way to measure your own thing. And I think you're right. I think a lot of times it does come back to like getting more time to do the things that you want, which is, you know, which we probably don't say that enough in just the world, but it's absolutely what people are thinking about.
Yeah. I forget where I got this from, but I remember in my newsletter sometime in the last few months, like I had a little entry that was like, people often forget and sorely underrate just being happy. like they really underrate just the value of being happy. And so like that's something you should pursue.
Well, we have done a good job. So Cote, we got through four of these. The link for all the rest of them are in the show notes. I'll just give quickly a highlights of what you'll learn about the other ones. Cote will teach you about how not to get homework in one specific video. He also will tell you how you can use homework to your advantage. I think those were really good ones. And he'll even tell you a little bit about how to innovate and maybe how exactly you do that in a big company. And then, of course, when the time comes, he'll tell you a little bit why you should always have an ask ready to go in case if you attend the large meeting. What are you going to do with, if you will, your opportunity to ask for something? So all of those are modules that are in there. Everyone should go sign up. I think Cote gets a small piece of that. And of course, O'Reilly gets it. Or just watch it through your company. Watch it through your company. And, you know, there's a quiz at the end and, you know, you get a good grade. I bet everyone will do well on the quiz. Cote, you mentioned some happiness, and one thing that makes people happy is going to conferences. So what conferences are coming up where people can find you?
Well, next week I'll be at DevOps Days LA on whatever Friday is next week, which is probably this week by the time you're listening to it. But you should have called in last week if you wanted to talk about pets.
There'll be no time travel. You won't be going to that. You won't be going to that conference.
It will be March 15th, which I think if you listen to this when we published it, will be today.
It'll be quick. It'll be very quick for you to make that conference.
But then also, Matt Ray and I will be at KubeCon EU March 19th and 22nd, which will be next week if you listen to this on time. And if you haven't registered for that yet, we have a discount code from VMware that will get you 20% off, which is KCEU24VMWBC20, which you could find if you go to softwaredefinedtalk.com/458. There's also DevOps Days Birmingham, which you can go to at April 17th and 18th. There's probably other events that are coming up. We have actually, I don't know if I've mentioned this here, but we're having an in-person event in Palo Alto on April 11th, I think, that's talking about like, what's up with Tanzu nowadays. Now, like a lot of events I get involved in nowadays, I'm going to be honest with you, all you listeners out there. It's kind of an invite-only thing for executive types, you know, the types of people who would be interested in buying Tanzu stuff. But if you think you're at one of these big global 2000 companies and you're some executive type, you should come check it out. We'll put a link to it in the show notes, but you can register for it. I'll be emceeing some stuff there, and you can come attend it. And I think I also got accepted to speak at NDC Oslo, which is, I don't know, sometime in the summer. There's many other ways.
I feel like we can learn something here. We should say maybe your champion at your company could, if you will, promote you going to visit Cote at his executive conference.
Yes.
You know, I'll be a chance. Or maybe you could take this as an ask to one of your executives and say, hey, we should both go. We should both
very
go
good
thing. And, you know, and they could bring you along and, you know, and you can learn all about Tanzu and explain it to me later. That would be great. Just be like, why are we doing this? Because Brandon needs a better explanation. So that'd be good enough for me on my expense report, right? You know, put it on there.
Yes.
Also, the other thing you can do to make yourself more happy in the happiness episode is you could get a sticker for Software Defined Talk. It's about to be summer. I'm going to be maybe going on a little vacation. So I think Software Defined Talk stickers are best on, you know, your water bottle, your tumblers, your Stanley cups, whatever. And so to get one, what you have to do is send your postal address to stickers@softwaredefinedtalk.com. I will be happy to send you a sticker anywhere in the world. And having said all that, Cote, do you have any exciting recommendations beyond your O'Reilly videos this week you want to share with us?
Well, I don't think I've recommended this before, but I want to recommend pecans, but in a very specific instance. Now, I've been trying to...
For the record, you definitely recommended pecans before, but no, go ahead. No, what's
well,
the
well, probably 458 episodes in. Surely I've recommended pecans. But okay. I've been making some smoothies for breakfast every now and then because they're fun. And what I like to do is put a bunch of pecans in there. Probably more pecans that are healthy. But, you know, you got your little... I don't like the gigantic blender. I've got like a smaller blender. And a Phillips one, but you got a little cup, you know, you put some milk, yogurt, blueberries, whatever you might have, and you put a bunch of pecans in there. And when you blend it up, it's a little chewy, but pecans are a great addition to a smoothie. And if you have the right size little blender, you know, the one with the wand, you don't even need a cup. You just mix it in the thing and you can drink it straight from the cup and, enjoy your pecans.
Like it. All right. Well, I'll just right off that one, I'll recommend a couple things. One, I actually have the giant blender. We have a Vitamix here at my house, and it's just, you know, the industrial strength. We've had it for like a long time, and we used it a lot when we first got it, but now the other night my wife broke it out. So it's good. It just to have a giant blender that sounds like an aircraft taking off in your kitchen. Like it literally have to mute the TV, the dog barks. It's just, you know, but it's awesome, right? So yeah, you can, if you're doing that, I'm sure it would take pecans just like it takes ice and everything else. So if you need a ridiculously expensive heavy duty blender, check out the Vitamix. And then I thought I'd some repeat recommendations for me, but I just thought like it went with this whole episode. Some things I was thinking about, I was watching some of your videos. Two books I've read that I think kind of hit on some of the themes in different ways. One is How Will You Measure Your Life? That's by the person that wrote
Clayton Christensen.
Yeah, Innovator's Dilemma. I think it was one of the final books, maybe the final book he wrote before he passed on. So he has a very analytical way of kind of evaluating, you know, your life. And he's got lots of good examples. He mentions a lot of famous people in it, like Jeffrey Skilling and a bunch of stuff like that. So if you're interested in kind of, well, I guess it's maybe like a psychology book kind of wrapped in a business book, but I still liked it. I thought it was good. And the other one, I've mentioned on the show before is The Psychology of Money, where the author really kind of goes through a lot of, things not about like investments, but just about thinking about money. And all the, again, the short story there is that like for the most part, more money in your life that leads to more time will make you more happy, right? Mm-hmm. More money that leads to more possessions that leads to like more work, probably not. So there you go. There's my one sentence review. Now, if you want to read the whole book, which is really good because it gives lots of examples and he tells you in a very soothing way. That is a great audio book. I just like, sometimes I just listen to the thing. Certain chapters, I just listen to them over. When I'm walking the dog, it's like, I don't know. Some people go to therapy. I walk the dog. I listen to this audio book and I find my zen. So all of that is there for you to check out. Hopefully you enjoy one of those books. And so Cote, you want to take us out? Give us your final send off. I'm sure you know exactly what episode we're on.
Yes. I just want to add that, like, I don't remember all the details of How Will You Measure Your Life, but I love the premise. He starts off and he's like, I was thinking about it. Here I am. He was at Harvard, right? Here I am at the Harvard School of Business. And I feel like maybe 5% of the people I've taught are in jail now.
Yeah.
What's up with that?
Real statistics. I mean, if everyone thinking that's like, oh, that's just an analogy. No, I think he actually did some math. He figured it out. So it
was just, he was just like, huh, maybe I should do something about that.
That is awesome. Yeah, go ahead.
Anyhow, good guy there, Clayton Christensen. This is episode 458 of your Software Defined Talk podcast. If you want to get the show notes for this episode, which are mostly just a link to my videos, which you should totally go watch, you can go to softwaredefinedtalk.com/458. Now, I want to say, as I recommend for our podcast, you should watch my videos. And if you work at a large organization, you probably have access to it already. Now, if you like the videos, you should read a stunning review, a 5-star review, and you can probably use the free tier of ChatGPT to come up with something if you don't want to write it on your own. If you didn't like the videos, I recommend Command-W or whatever the Windows equivalent is to close a window, and you can just get on with your life. You don't need to spend time writing a review. I don't want to impose on you. You can just exit and go on living your life. You want to have review life in balance. But you should check those out. They're great videos, unless you don't like them, in which case you don't need to say anything. And with that, we'll see everyone next time. Bye-bye. It was making me think I was being like that Ron Burgundy guy, where if you put it on the teleprompter, he will read it.